The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
I'm a squeaky toy, and I've got one job, getting chomped on by this little ankle sniffer. So pardon me for feeling inept compared to Geico, who does so much more. Like, while I'm getting slobbered on, Geico is creating cool technology like their mobile app, which lets people pay their bills or file a claim. Plus, Geico is the fastest growing auto insurer for the last 10 years. Is it too much for me to ask for one more feature? Fast and friendly claim service like Geico, maybe? Oh, great. I'm getting buried again.
Geico. Expect great savings and a whole lot more.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, another deadly school rampage.
He wasn't happy, so he had to take it out on people that were just so beautiful.
Plus, the U.S. accuses more than a dozen Russians of interfering with the 2016 election.
This indictment offers new insights into the alleged Russian conspiracy to meddle in American politics.
Later, a White House fracture.
The Porter scandal has left the West Wing demoralized, exhausted, and mistrustful.
I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Authorities in Florida and from the FBI are investigating why 19-year-old Nicholas Cruz allegedly rampaged through Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland Wednesday. Police say he killed 17 people.
Students ran for their lives, dropping books and bags after witnessing classmates cut down by bullets.
Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel.
At 2:21 hours and 33 seconds, the suspect readied his rifle and began shooting into rooms.
The sheriff said Nicholas Cruz began firing at four classrooms on the first floor. The suspected shooter then made his way to the second floor, shot one victim, then went to the third floor where he dropped his rifle and backpack.
The suspect crossed fields and ran west along with others who were fleeing and tried to mix in with the group that were running away.
Cruz turned up at a Walmart and bought a drink at a Subway sandwich shop. After a brief stop at McDonald's, he left at 3:01 p.m. As bullets rang out, students quietly hid wherever they could. As police raced to their rescue, Coconut Creek officer Michael Leonard was the first to spot Cruz.
I discovered an individual walking on the sidewalk that was wearing the clothing description that had been given over the radio. He complied with my commands and was taken into custody without any issues.
There needs to be justice. And friends are gone.
Student Tyra Heeman says she knew Cruz was troubled, but did not believe he was capable of killing her friend, Joaquin, and assistant football coach Aaron Feiss.
He wasn't happy, so he had to take it out on people that were just so beautiful.
Sheriff Israel once again repeated the call for anyone who sees or hears something suspicious to report it.
Someone came forward to your agency with information about this suspect. What could you legally have done about the fact that he owned a gun?
If he legally owned a gun, we couldn't do anything about arresting him for having a gun, but we could certainly follow up. We could certainly go to visit him, whether he legally owns a gun or not.
The ATS says Cruz purchased that AR-15 rifle 1 year ago. So far, 2,000 people have been interviewed as part of this investigation. Manuel Bojorquez, CBS News, Parkland, Florida.
Florida Governor Rick Scott is calling on FBI Director Chris Wray to resign after discovering the FBI failed to investigate a tip about Cruz, one of what may be several missed warnings about him.
There were many missed signs about alleged school shooter Nicholas Cruz. Sarah Lowy knew him from his job at a dollar store.
He followed me on Instagram, and I saw all of the pictures of his guns. He had a picture of his gun up to his face.
Many saw the gun obsession and the threats by the 19-year-old through his social media postings. Lowy is now second-guessing herself.
As soon as I heard what happened, immediately my mind was, I should have done something.
A Mississippi man, Ben Benight, says he contacted the FBI last September about a YouTube video he saw from a user identified as Nicholas Cruz, threatening to become, quote, a professional school shooter.
Anybody that makes a public statement like that definitely needs to be investigated.
The FBI says it wasn't able to track him down. Jim Crisula, CBS News, Parkland, Florida.
Correspondent Hannah Doba has more on some of the victims killed in the attack.
The kids in this community loved him. They adored him. He was one of the greatest people I knew.
Assistant football coach Aaron Feiss was killed as he threw himself in front of students to protect them. A former student and player at Marjorie Stoneman, he leaves behind a wife and daughter. Joaquin Oliver from Venezuela had just become a U.S. citizen. 14-year-old Jamie Gutenberg loved to dance and hoped to become an occupational therapist. Her family doesn't know how it will cope.
She's like, I gotta go, Dad, bye. And I don't always get to say, I love you. I don't remember if I said that to Jamie yesterday morning.
Alyssa Al-Hadef was a talented soccer player. Her mother said all she had to offer the world was love. Peter Wang, a 15-year-old, was last seen holding a door open so others could escape. Carmen Shentrup was a semifinalist for a National Merit Scholarship. Elena Petty helped victims of Hurricane Irma rebuild. Nicholas Dwart was a swimmer who had committed to swim for the University of Indianapolis. And geography teacher Scott Beagle was killed helping students enter a locked classroom to avoid the gunman.
He was just an amazing person, Mr. Beagle, his name, and he will forever be in my heart and forever be my hero because he basically saved my life.
Hannah Doba, CBS News.
More calls for gun control reform.
I'm Peter King.
17 too many! 17 too many! We are angry! We want angry!
Dozens of high school students in Hollywood, just a few miles from where 17 Parkland students were killed. Amy Campbell Oates says she hopes lawmakers all the way up to the White House hear the message and act on it.
We're out here because we're sick of this. It's been like 6 years since Sandy Hook, and there have been shootings every single year, every single month there have been shootings.
Students demonstrated as the first funeral was held just a few miles away. 14-year-old Alyssa Al-Hadef. Peter King, CBS News near Parkland, Florida.
Correspondent Terry Okita in London looks at how other countries have responded to mass shootings and gun ownership.
Mass shootings in the U.S. continue to make headlines around the world.
Gun attack at a school in Florida.
The U.S. has 270 million guns, more than any other country. And with that, the most mass shooters. America's gun culture and violence is baffling to many Europeans.
The firepower is there, but the civic responsibility is not there. And that has disastrous results.
UK criminology professor Peter Squire says after Britain's worst mass shooting at a school in Scotland in 1996, lawmakers banned handguns immediately with little outside influence from gun advocates.
There's nothing like the gun lobby, the NRA, in any European countries.
Of all the gun-owning countries, the U.S. comes out on top, with nearly double the weapons of the war-torn Arab nation of Yemen. Switzerland, Finland, Cyprus, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq fall far behind. Britain has some of the toughest gun laws in the world. Police recently launched a gun amnesty program to get even more firearms away from criminals.
This is part of our response to try and make it as difficult as possible for those people to come into possession of any type of weapon at all.
And while there's ongoing debate in Britain over arming police officers, especially in the fight against terrorism, many Brits say it's a step they're not ready to take. Terry Okita, CBS News, London.
Still to come, new indictments against Russians accused of a massive political conspiracy. That's next on the Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. A federal grand jury has indicted 13 Russians and three Russian entities, accusing them of participating in a massive, multi-million-dollar online operation to interfere with the 2016 presidential election. Let's talk with CBS News White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Stephen, what does the indictment allege they did?
The special counsel says that the Russians named in the indictment stole real American social security numbers and dates of birth to open PayPal accounts, which they then used to buy social media advertising in the Americans' names. A round-the-clock Russian online marketing effort is depicted in this indictment. It says that they were bent at first on defeating Hillary Clinton, doing what they could to promote Donald Trump's candidacy, at first promoting Bernie Sanders' candidacy as well, as along with that of Green Party candidate Jill Stein, all in an effort to defeat Hillary Clinton. But what's interesting is that the indictment alleges that after the president's election in November of 2016, the Russians then also organized anti-Trump rallies in New York and North Carolina, at the same time that they organized pro-Trump rallies, which essentially bolsters the argument that we've been hearing from American officials
that the real Russian effort here, in addition to propagating the campaign of Donald Trump, was to just sow discord in American society generally and in American politics in particular.
So it wasn't necessarily to elect Donald Trump, and in fact, it apparently didn't have any effect on the outcome?
Well, we heard from Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein on Friday as he unveiled this indictment. He said that there's no evidence presented that the Russian efforts necessarily had an outcome on the election. He also said that there's no evidence that the Americans who in some way were influenced by the Russian effort knew what they were doing or knew that they were communicating with or working with Russians.
But how does this look for the White House and for President Trump?
It doesn't look particularly bad for the president, I'd say, because of the very clear and emphatic statement on the part of the special counsel and the deputy attorney general that there's no evidence, at least none that's presented here, that there was any overt collusion, to use that word, between the Russian effort and the Trump campaign. That has been the allegation that has fueled this entire investigation. And a lingering question that will last for a while is what more the special counsel needs to know about the Russian effort in 2016.
CBS News White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Thanks, Stephen.
You bet.
The indictments follow warnings from the top U.S. intelligence chiefs to the Senate Intelligence Committee that Russia could target U.S. midterm elections. More from correspondent Jeff Pegues.
Frankly, the United States is under attack.
Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence, said Russia is already working to disrupt this year's midterm elections.
We need to inform the American public that this is real, that this is going to be happening, and the resilience needed for us to stand up and say we're not going to allow some Russian to tell us how to vote.
Senate Democrats said that national cry needs to begin with President Trump.
I believe that he feels that he and Russia did not meddle in the election. As to whether I believe it or not, I'm with our agencies.
But he has sent mixed messages about Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Rhode Island Senator Jack Reed.
Has the president directed you and your agency to take specific actions to confront and blunt Russian influence activities that are ongoing?
We're taking a lot of specific efforts to blunt Russian
efforts. Directed by the president?
Not as specifically directed by the president.
In 2016, Russian hackers targeted voter systems in at least 21 states, but there is still no coordinated national strategy to counter similar Russian operations this year. The Department of Homeland Security has encouraged select state elections officials to get security clearances so they can be more fully briefed. But sources have described the initial federal involvement as bizarre and a complete waste of time.
Do you disagree with that?
We spoke with then-Virginia Elections Commissioner Edgardo Cortez in October.
I don't disagree that some of the briefings have been not exceptionally helpful. I need to know what actions do I need to take to make my system secure against any cyber threat.
DHS says that it is providing state and local election officials with real-time threat information. It has also set up a council to better coordinate information sharing, but that council did not become a reality until about a year after the 2016 election. Jeff Pegues, CBS News, Washington.
The resignation of a top aide continues to plague the White House. Here's correspondent Major Garrett.
I am totally opposed to domestic violence of any kind. Everyone knows that.
President Trump broke his silence on domestic abuse a week after one of his top aides, Rob Porter, resigned following accusations of abuse by two ex-wives, charges Porter denies.
And it almost wouldn't even have to be said. So now you hear it, but you all know it.
The Porter scandal has left the West Wing demoralized, exhausted, and mistrustful. One senior official said top White House staff are, quote, not telling us the truth. Chief of Staff John Kelly and White House counsel Don McGahn were in a position to know more about Porter than they have acknowledged.
This is deciding whether or not to hire someone.
House Oversight Committee Chairman Trey Gowdy launched an investigation into White House decisions on Porter's employment and security clearance, saying he wants answers from Kelly and McGahn.
I cannot fathom how someone, if they had access to this information and the photographs, could extend an offer of employment to someone with this in their background.
Some media outlets reported the number of White House staffers with an interim security clearance was more than 100, including McGahn, plus Ivanka Trump, and Jared Kushner.
A failure in Congress to work out a compromise on immigration reform.
The Senate tried.
The motion is not agreed to.
But failed to pass four separate immigration proposals Thursday.
This does not have to be the end of our efforts to resolve these matters.
Even a bill drafted by a bipartisan group of senators failed to get the 60 votes needed to pass. It would have funded the president's border wall while providing a path to citizenship for the undocumented immigrants who were brought to the country illegally as children.
This provides $25 billion for a border security system. Number two, it addresses the issue of DACA. It takes care of 1.8 million young people who want to be citizens in the United States 10 to 12 years from now.
The White House threatened to veto the bill because it doesn't stop family-based migration or end the visa lottery program. Democrats say that veto threat killed its chances of passing.
President Trump created this problem by terminating the DACA program last August. Since that decision, President Trump has stood in the way of every single proposal that could become law.
The White House says it's Democrats who are standing in the way. Administration officials say they'll now focus on a House immigration proposal that addresses the issues President Trump wants solved. The president tweeted, "Cannot believe how badly DACA recipients have been treated by the Democrats. Totally abandoned. Republicans are still working hard." The House bill, sponsored by Virginia Republican Bob Goodlatte, is even further right than the Republican-backed bill in the Senate, which garnered only 39 votes. Mola Lenghi, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
Up next, 50 years of 911.
911, state your emergency.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS News Radio app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up. It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, Weekend Roundup, or the CBS Evening News.
And good evening. Wall Street today signaled its approval of the tax cuts passed by the Republican-controlled Congress.
You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS News Radio app for iOS or Android. Download it today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. A security scare at the NSA in Maryland. More from correspondent Weijia Jiang.
Several bullets pierced the windshield of a black SUV outside the headquarters of the National Security Agency. The FBI says the vehicle tried to drive through a security gate and onto the campus at Fort Meade early Wednesday morning. The NSA says an officer followed security protocols and fired shots. The FBI says one of the men in the vehicle was hurt and taken to the hospital, along with an NSA officer and a bystander. But it doesn't appear any of their injuries were gun-related. Investigators are still trying to determine why the men drove onto the NSA campus in the first place.
We believe there is no indication that this has a nexus to terrorism, or do we believe that this is anything but an isolated event?
The incident is reminiscent of a deadly shooting in March 2015 when the NSA opened fire on another SUV that tried to ram the gate, killing the driver and wounding the passenger. Weijia Jiang, CBS News, Fort Meade, Maryland.
A scare for some members of the Trump family after they received an envelope with white powder in Manhattan.
The Secret Service and New York City police officers responded to the home of Donald Trump Jr.'s mother-in-law on Manhattan's East Side.
Crazy things happen in New York or all over the world.
Vanessa Trump opened the envelope addressed to her husband, which contained a white powder. She called 911 and said she was coughing and felt nauseated. She was taken to the hospital as a precaution. None of the couple's five children was home at the time. Neighbors were alarmed.
I think it's terrifying. I think it's terrifying that anybody would send a package like that, regardless of who it was to.
Preliminary tests show the substance wasn't dangerous, but further testing will be required to determine what was in the envelope and who sent it. Donald Trump Jr. tweeted, "Thankful Vanessa and my children are safe and unharmed," and called the incident disturbing behavior. The Secret Service says this is an active investigation and would not comment any further. Kenneth Craig, CBS News, New York.
Now to fighting the flu and putting it to the test.
We generally do about 3 minutes per swab.
That's a long time.
Yes.
Germs, good or bad, hide in plain sight.
It could be human cells, animal cells, viruses, fungi, bacteria.
Chris Mason, a geneticist at Weill Cornell Medicine, is using a four-step method known as shotgun sequencing.
This is basically taking whatever DNA is there and pulling it out and then mapping it all to all the known species.
The results will tell us the hotspot areas bacteria and viruses are hiding, including the flu.
What are some of the areas in an office where we might be most susceptible?
The areas where there's the most flu and microbes are really the high-touch surfaces, so things like the kitchen sink, door handles, elevator buttons.
And the places you find the most bacteria, that's the same places you find the most viral particles?
Right. You'll find bacteria and viruses will come together as a big sort of microbe cloud that follow you around.
The CDC says the influenza virus can live on some surfaces for up to a day. So we tested four common office spots to see where the dangers lie. First, the break room.
This is an area where people touch a lot, things splash around. It could even lead to ways, you know, essentially things could grow because it's a moist enough area.
Then the conference room.
Basically, cells and viruses and other sort of entities can build up in the small porous areas.
So things like this, like a chair in a conference room or a sofa or a couch.
Fabrics, anything that's
not
really
good.
It's basically like a big sponge. And
big
so
breeding area.
An easy one to overlook, the stair railing.
This is really a place where many, many hands are touching.
And something most of us can't avoid.
Keyboard, which I imagine is colonized with a lot of bacteria and viruses.
Yes, indeed.
The swabs were taken to their lab for testing and analysis. The results? They did not detect any flu, but found bacteria and other viruses. The keyboard was the most contaminated, followed by the break room, the railing, then the conference room.
More reason to wash your hands. That's Dr. Tara Narula reporting. 50 years of 911.
911, state your emergency.
One of hundreds of millions of calls made since the first 911 was dialed in Haleyville, Alabama, February 16, 1968. The commercial call was placed by then-State House Speaker Rankin Fite. The emergency call system was an effort to demonstrate the power of the phone industry. Most who staff the helplines are highly trained communications pros.
You're just trying to do the best you can to get help to the people.
Today, 96% of the U.S. has access to 911. Gary Nunn, CBS News.
A new front may be opening in Syria's war after Israel shot down a drone. Correspondent Seth Doan explains.
Israel accuses Iran of using a base inside Syria to launch the drone. Israel retaliated with a strike from an F-16, and Syrians fired back, knocking an Israeli jet out of the sky for the first time in 36 years.
I think both sides don't want to go to war, and the very delicate decisions between escalation and containment will continue to be the main dilemma for the decision makers.
Amos Yadlin is a former Israeli Army intelligence chief who's worried about arch-enemy Iran using the chaos of Syria from which to attack Israel.
This is about Iran building a force in Syria against Israel and Israel's determination not to let it happen.
What is so shocking about this location is that we're more than 60 miles from the border with Syria. That Syrian anti-aircraft missile struck down that plane inside Israeli airspace. Seth Doan, CBS News, Harduf, Israel.
Shifting to the royals now, with soon-to-be-married Prince Harry and Meghan Markle visiting Scotland.
A biting north wind did little to chill the enthusiasm of Scots welcoming the prince and his bride-to-be to Edinburgh. The iconic Edinburgh Castle provided the stage to the couple's first official joint visit to Scotland. Their next stop, considerably less grand, a pretty unremarkable cafe that has done some pretty remarkable things for the homeless. Social bite, and Meghan Markle is not the most famous Hollywood star to visit. George Clooney's a fan, and Leonardo DiCaprio. And though founder Josh Littlejohn had courted Hollywood royalty, the request from, well, actual royalty came as a surprise.
Just got an email saying that Prince Harry and Meghan Markle are planning to visit Edinburgh on this particular date, and they would like to come and visit Social Bite.
His restaurants not only feed the homeless, but employs them too, and all profits go toward helping their plight. Catering assistant Sonny Murray used to be a heroin addict.
It's totally changed my life, right?
The ability to change lives is one reason convincing George Clooney to sprinkle a little stardust to raise the charity's profile isn't hard.
Different. George Clooney was just unbelievably charming and funny, and he had the whole staff and stitches.
And while that spotlight helped Prince Harry and Meghan Markle take notice, Battling homelessness is an issue the couple have already held close to their hearts.
Charlie Daggett of CBS News, Edinburgh, Scotland.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, how Americans are doing at the Olympics. Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio. And I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Let's turn to the Olympics now with a look at some of the week's biggest moments and stories. First, to correspondent Steve Futterman in Pyeongchang.
Just one day after she did this.
And it's gold for Michaela Schifrin in the giant slalom.
American ski star Michaela Schifrin did this.
There will be no gold medal for Michaela Schifrin.
The call on Westwood won as Schifrin, the favorite in the slalom, finished a respectable but very unsatisfying fourth.
I am disappointed. I think everybody can see that. But I did not feel like myself today.
And that wasn't the only disappointment for the U.S.
Quadruple Lutz, fall.
The top American men's figure skater, Nathan Chen, thought by many to have a chance for gold, had a disastrous short program. Steve Futterman, CBS News, at the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang.
Correspondent Ben Tracy has more on the triumph of snowboarder Shaun White.
Shaun White, the oldest man in the competition, put on an air show.
What?
After a shocking fourth-place finish in the Sochi Olympics 4 years ago, he had some unfinished business.
Shaun White, the biggest run of his life right now.
White was in second place going into his third and final run.
For the gold!
He attacked the wall, turning back-to-back 14-40s. It's an improbable snowboarding trick that just 4 months ago, White seriously injured himself trying to perfect. It was perfect in Pyeongchang.
And gets it!
White's massive final run earned him a record third gold of his groundbreaking snowboarding career.
I'm so proud to say that I've kind of like found the love of the sport again.
But with White back in the spotlight, accusations are resurfacing that he sexually harassed a former member of his band.
Honestly, here to talk about the Olympics, not, you know, gossip. So
he denies most of her allegations, but does admit to sending her sexually explicit pictures and texts.
Those allegations were part of the band member's 2016 lawsuit, and that lawsuit has now been settled. Ben Tracy, CBS News, Pyeongchang, South Korea.
Correspondent Dana Jacobson talks with one Olympian fresh off the fast track.
I didn't think it would happen this soon.
Long track speed skater Aaron Jackson is a surprise member of this year's Olympic team, taking up ice skating just 4 months ago.
I still sometimes just don't believe it. I don't understand how it could have happened.
A heavily decorated inline speed skater, Jackson has been on wheels since she was a kid. When inline speed skating wasn't enough,
her second pass through the pack,
she gave roller derby a spin. And when the time was right to go from wheels to ice, she jumped at it.
What was the most challenging thing about it?
The techniques are pretty different. With ice, you really have to dig in. It was pretty frustrating at first.
Perhaps the best part for her is that her dad will be there, thanks to an online fundraiser and a last-minute Bridgestone sponsorship. After all, dad was her first call when she made the Olympic team.
Not often that you see him get excited, but when he answered the phone, I don't remember his exact words, but it was something like, oh, so you went pretty fast, huh?
And that is Jackson's Olympics goal, just to be faster. She says it's the same goal she had in the trials. And look what happened. Dana Jacobson, CBS News, Milwaukee.
In Oregon, scary moments on Mount Hood when a climber slid some 700 feet down its face Tuesday morning.
The climber was airlifted by a Black Hawk helicopter to a medical center where he was declared dead. He was part of a team of four climbers. They were stranded in a climbing route known as Hog's Back, more than 10,000 feet up the mountain. A crew of at least 40 assisted in the rescue effort. One says, with the falling rock and ice, it felt like being in a bowling alley.
The conditions up there are bad for hikers, climbers, and quite frankly for the rescuers as well.
It took 8 hours for rescuers to bring two other men in the group to safety. The fourth climber was rescued by sled. Authorities say she suffered no severe physical injuries, but was apparently too distraught by her teammate's death to climb down unassisted. She was later able to walk off this rescue vehicle on her own.
So you said the one woman was very shaken up.
Absolutely. Yeah, from what I understand, like that was kind of her climbing mentor. So they had done a lot of climbing together. So very, very personal situation for her.
Another group of three hikers became stranded and also had to be rescued. They're all okay, and none of them had life-threatening injuries. The Oregonian says 10,000 people a year climb Mount Hood. There have been 100 deaths, four of which occurred in 2017. Jamie Yukas, CBS News, Mount Hood, Oregon.
Another disaster at an iconic American location, the Grand Canyon. Three British tourists were killed when a helicopter crashed there.
Federal investigators will help piece together what led to a sightseeing helicopter crash in the Grand Canyon Saturday evening. The rescue and recovery effort lasted until 2 in the morning Sunday.
We were hampered by severe weather conditions. We had gusts up to 50 miles an hour. The terrain where the crash occurred in Quartermaster Canyon is extremely rugged. It's only accessible by aircraft, and our first responders had a 20-minute hike to get to the scene.
The chopper was carrying a pilot and six passengers when it crashed and burned in a part of Arizona's Grand Canyon, 73 miles east of Las Vegas. Teddy Fujimoto, a wedding photographer that happened to be nearby, and saw some of the survivors emerging from the wreckage.
It was pretty bad. It's amazing how they survived. These two ladies, you know, are lucky to be alive.
The helicopter belongs to Papillon Airways, one of the biggest Grand Canyon tour companies in the area.
This is the first with Papillon, the first major crash that we know of since the 2001 incident.
Back in 2001, the tour company was involved in another helicopter crash that killed six people. That accident was found to be the result of pilot error. Laura Podesta, CBS News.
Investigators are probing a plane crash near Moscow.
Fragments of the Russian plane scattered across a snowy field southeast of Moscow. Russian officials say all 65 passengers and six crew members on board died. Flight 703 took off from Moscow's Domodedovo Airport on Sunday afternoon. It was heading to the city of Orsk in central Russia. But minutes later, the aircraft disappeared from radar screens and went down about 25 miles from the airport. This witness described hearing an explosion that made his house tremble. Another said she saw shattered body parts in the field and no survivors. Most of the victims were reportedly from the Orsk region. One was Swiss. At the local airport, relatives sobbed and paced as news of the crash spread. Russian media say the airliner had been flying since 2010 with a two-year break because of a shortage of parts. But a spokeswoman for Russia's Saratov Airlines, which operated the plane, said there were no concerns about its condition. Russia's aviation safety record was poor in the 1990s and into the 2000s, but has improved in recent years. Russia's transport ministry says it's looking into several possible causes for Sunday's crash, including bad weather and human error.
Russian investigators say the crew on the flight did not report any technical problems before the crash. The mayor of Orsk, where the plane was heading, says Monday will be a day of mourning throughout the region. Roxana Saberi, CBS News, London.
Coming up, taking on Antarctica.
Worsley hoped to walk across Antarctica, and he hoped to do it alone.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Like what you're hearing? Get even more great content from CBS News Radio podcasts. Listen to TV broadcasts like CBS Evening News and Face the Nation on demand.
I'm John Dickerson.
And don't miss The Takeout, a politics, policy, and pop culture podcast from CBS News Chief White House Correspondent Major Garrett.
We have our first member of the Trump administration cabinet at our table, Mick Mulvaney.
Were you asked the wrong people first?
Subscribe now at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Google Play.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Writer David Grand tells the story of two remarkable men in The New Yorker. Both men, explorers, Ernest Shackleton and Henry Worsley, separated by a century but united by a continent. David, can you explain Worsley's mission to Antarctica?
Yeah, so Henry Worsley grew up worshiping Ernest Shackleton, the great British explorer of the early 20th century, and he decided he wanted to do what his hero was unable to do, which was to walk across Antarctica, which was something that Shackleton had hoped to do before his ship was frozen in ice and sank, and he had to abandon the mission. So Worsley hoped to walk across Antarctica, and he hoped to do it alone. And without the help of any dogs, without the help of kites, it was something that had never been attempted before.
I can't imagine that conditions on Antarctica improved much over the last century, which scuttled Shackleton's mission. So what was different for Worsley?
Well, the conditions were, as you say, very similar in the sense that Antarctica remains one of the most brutal and inhospitable environments in the world, with temperatures that can reach 100, minus 100 degrees Fahrenheit, gale force hurricane winds regularly. Worsley was trapped constantly in whiteouts. I would say the advantage he had was he had a satellite phone, which was powered by solar batteries, and that was his one big advantage in that he could signal for help if he needed it.
So Worsley filed some of these audio dispatches.
Well, it's almost been a punishing day. All was looking good at the outset, although an 80% whiteout persisted all day.
Clearly, he's in some challenging situations. How did he trace his journey?
Henry's mission was to walk from one side of the continent to the other. It was more than 1,000 miles, this trip. And before he went to bed, he would call a friend on a satellite phone in London and record an audio diary, updating his listeners, who grew as the trip went on.
Why do this?
Wow, that is the hardest question to answer, and I think something that even Worsley's family asks. I think for Henry, I think one component was really an inward journey as much as an external journey to kind of singularly test his character, to kind of figure out what kind of clay he was made of. And he also had always worshipped Shackleton, and Shackleton became for him a way of almost getting closer to himself. He would study Shackleton, the decisions Shackleton made. Shackleton became very famous, not because he succeeded in his missions. In fact, he always failed. The environment always, in many ways, defeated him. But he always managed to get his men back alive. And so Worsley really studied his decision-making under great duress to see how he did that.
What happened to him?
Well, he faced just incredibly harsh conditions from one whiteout to another. He made it all the way to the South Pole, which was completing the first phase of his journey. And then he had about 300 more nautical miles to go to complete his trek. But after he left the South Pole on this second phase, he began to lose weight. He had lost more than 40 pounds. He was suffering from frostbite in his hands. His feet were bruised and discolored. Every part of his body ached, and he began to eventually break down toward the end of the trip. He only had really just about a percentage, 1% more of the trip to go, and he suddenly faced this agonizing decision about what to do. He was so close to making history, but it was getting harder and harder for him even to put one ski in front of the other. And he had always asked himself when he was in duress, what would Shax do? What would Shackleton do? And he ultimately decided what Shackleton would have done in that moment was he would have turned back. And so at that moment, Henry called on his satellite phone for a rescue plane to come get him. And he was medevaced out, and he called his lovely wife in London and said, "I'm going to be fine. I'm having a cup of tea." But then very unexpectedly, he was not aware just the degree that his body had just broken down. He had a perforation in his abdomen lining, and he began to go into septic shock. He was rushed into surgery. They tried to save him. His wife got updates, and ultimately he died on the operating table.
A sad ending to a brave man.
He was incredibly brave, incredibly courageous, incredibly determined. And, his feats of endurance are really almost incomparable. And what was so tragic was he ultimately made the right decision. And unfortunately, it was probably just a few days too late.
New Yorker writer David Grant on the Weekend Roundup. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Finally, this President's Day weekend, a former president and first lady in portrait.
As President Obama unveiled his official portrait, it became apparent something was different.
I tried to negotiate smaller ears.
It wasn't the ears or the graying hair, which, according to the president, artist Kehinde Wiley had too much integrity to change. It was the informal setting, former leader of the free world surrounded by flowers.
All of them giving little nods to his own path here on the earth.
African blue lilies for his Kenyan heritage, jasmine for his birth state of Hawaii, and the official flower of Chicago, chrysanthemums. Wiley said he hoped his subject's personality would come through.
What Barack Obama wanted was a sense that he was a man of the people, that sense of access, that sense of the unbuttoned collar, the seated, relaxed pose.
Obama said he picked Wiley because he's different.
What I was always struck by whenever I saw his portraits was the degree to which they challenged our conventional views of power and privilege.
The official portrait of the former First Lady also challenges the norms. Amy Sherald painted Michelle Obama in gray skin tone over a bright blue background, an image she hopes will inspire young women of color.
Who in years ahead will come to this place and they will look up and they will see an image of someone who looks like them hanging on the wall.
Jan Crawford, reporting from the Smithsonian National Portrait Gallery here in Washington. That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com and let us know where and how you're listening. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Mitchell Fallon is our intern. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.